D with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to episode number 144 of the Robots Podcast. I am Jana and today we will be hearing about the use of robotics in explosive disposal by military personnel. But first, we, the people behind the Robots Podcast and the RoboHub website, would like to make a short announcement because we need your help. We've been steadily growing since our humble beginnings, and in order for us to continue covering the latest in robotics research, showcasing interviews with leading roboticists, and bringing in-depth coverage of conferences worldwide, we need your support. That's why we're putting out a call for donations. Our fundraising campaign will run from December 1st to December 9th, and we'll aim to collect vital funds so we can continue to let you know what's happening in robotics around the world. If you think we're doing a good job and would like to see the Robots Podcast continue and thrive, please consider making a contribution. You can donate via our website at robotspodcast.com or at robohub.org. Your donation will go towards expanding our coverage, paying the salaries of our dedicated staff, and maintaining the website. No contribution is too small, and your donation will really make a difference. And now, without further ado, here are the latest news and developments in robotics with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. 2 weeks after the IRIS and IREX conferences, the blogosphere is still busy digesting all the robotics news. However, one of the most interesting and relevant innovations has gone almost entirely unnoticed. A robot guide dog for the visually impaired by Japanese company NSK. As an in-depth, yet little read article by the founder of Gizmac points out, NSK is one of those companies that makes products that you use every day, but that are usually buried somewhere within another company's product, such as bearings, and since 2009, robot aids for the visually impaired, which, in Japan alone, are more than 1.6 million people. At this year's IREX, NSK introduced a new version of the robot guide, as well as the prototype of the much lighter version Lightbot. Like a guide dog, Lightbot automatically senses which way a user wants to go and skirts around obstacles in the path. And at just below 10 kilograms, it's light enough to be carried on escalators and upstairs. Lightbot only works in 2D because it has wheels. But NSK is also working on, and has previously shown, an early prototype of a quadruped robot with the same functionality. In other news, a video of three girls constructing a crazy Rube Goldberg machine has gone viral in the past week, collecting more than 8 million views in less than 1 week. The video was created by U.S. toy company Goldieblocks with a mission statement to show the world that girls deserve more choices than dolls and princesses. And finally, the world's first documented robot suicide happened in Austria last week. The iRobot Roomba 760's owner had put the machine on the counter to clean up spilled cereal and insists that he turned it off before leaving the house. The robot then appears to have headed for the hot stove, where it pushed a pot out of its way and started to melt, and finally burst into flames. By the time its owner returned, all that was left was a pile of ash. In spite of its tragic fate, the robot's owner had little sympathy. "I would never buy one again. You buy them to keep the place clean, not to almost burn it down and ruin everything." For more information on NSK's robot guide dog, a video of the crazy Rube Goldberg machine, and a photo of a pile of ash, have a look at robohub.org.
Julie Carpenter recently graduated with a PhD from the University of Washington. Her interests focus on investigating the social dynamic between users and robots. As part of her PhD, she interviewed 23 U.S. military explosive ordnance disposal personnel to find out how they interact with everyday field robots, such as Packbot and Talon. Julie spoke to our interviewer about the findings of her research and the intricacies of human-robot interaction in the field.
All right, so thank you for joining us, Julie.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
So I understand that you've just finished your PhD in education on the thesis called The Quiet Professional, an investigation of U.S. military explosive ordnance disposal personnel interactions with everyday field robots. So I find it fascinating that you chose to do your PhD in human-robot interaction with military robots while pursuing a doctoral degree in education. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as you know, the field of human-robot interaction is, you know, highly interdisciplinary. I have a background in an academic background in technical communication. I have a professional background in usability studies. The College of Education at University of Washington was just a great fit for me. They're looking at their learning sciences or cognitive psychology area. And my advisor and my committee gave me a tremendous amount of support and latitude to pursue the type of technology interactions I was interested in. So I said robots, and they said, great. As a matter of fact, they already have people in that department, such as Andrew Meltzoff, that tackle it from a neuropsychology end. So I'm not the first human-robot interaction person in UW's College of Ed.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's very interesting. So from the title of your thesis, your focus is it's on explosive ordnance disposal personnel.
Mm-hmm.
So these are people working in battlefields whose job is to literally find and remove bombs, right?
Well, they're EOD or explosive ordnance disposal personnel. I mean, they're highly trained people. Their job is to render safe unexploded ordnance, and that's a range of things: chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, improvised explosive devices. They frequently work with civilian authorities like the police or first responders. They're responsible for providing security for large events. They have for something like, you would say, the Olympics, they would, you know, perhaps sweep the area for possible unexploded ordnance. And yes, they also work, they're deployed and work in battle situations.
Gotcha. So can you paint us a bit of a picture of what kind of interaction these people might have with robots?
Well, the models that they use every day, I mean, the people I spoke to, if I said describe a typical day, they really couldn't describe a typical day working with robots. But in the team, there's generally one person who's an operator who is responsible during a mission, the course of a mission, for operating these semi-autonomous robots, though all EOD have similar initial training with robotics or with these robots. If they're deployed, they can be called out several times a day to inspect what could possibly be a suspicious something that looks like an improvised explosive device. They might take the robots out to practice with. They might informally, like perhaps an obstacle course they or their team leader designed. They take part in lots of ongoing training, formalized training, where it's just an ongoing learning process for them, which is also related to education. They're in a constant state of training. And, you know, with something like improvised explosive devices, they're not mass-produced, obviously. They're essentially homemade bombs. And the techniques and tactics and procedures people use to make and produce IEDs are changing all the time. And explosive ordnance disposal personnel learn from post-blast analysis and forensic analysis how these things are changing. So they go through quite a bit of ongoing training with the robots and learning about the explosives themselves.
Mm-hmm. And they're doing these trainings and investigations using different types of robots, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah, frequently models that they discuss when speaking to me, I should mention there was a fairly wide range of ages in the people I spoke with, and I also spoke with people in all branches of the U.S. military. So depending on when they were actually in the military, they might have used one model more than another. Sometimes they have a preference for one model over another. But typically robots that were used when I spoke to people were iRobot's PackBot or Kinetic's Talon model.
Okay. So are these just a handful of robots that these personnel have that are shared, or did each person have their own robot that they're responsible for?
The teams generally, when they were called to a mission during deployment, would have, if possible, two working robots, one that they would intend to use and one that was ready as a spare if the first robot became disabled for any reason. PackBot, I believe, it's a smaller model. And so, it depends on the nature of the mission and the military branch and availability of robots and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that you conducted a series of interviews of these military personnel. What were you looking to find from these interviews?
Basically, with this sort of research, and I should say they took part in a questionnaire as well as the one-on-one interviews I did with them. And I, because so little work has been done in this area from an emotional sort of standpoint or a social dynamic standpoint, I was really looking to sort of investigate and describe the phenomenon that are happening. I mean, I wanted to hear firsthand from the experts, the people that are using these robots every day, what their own experiences were.
Mm-hmm. And is there a particular reason why you chose the robots used for EOD?
Well, they're certainly fascinating. I mean, explosive ordnance disposal personnel are certainly a fascinating line of work. I've had an interest in looking at military use of field robots for a long time, probably at least my whole doctoral program. That's been something that I've been building toward, and when I finally had the opportunity to recruit or work with some participants within the military, it sort of became a self-selecting group of people in that those that were volunteering to take part ended up becoming explosive ordnance disposal personnel as a group, which was actually, it worked out wonderfully in a lot of ways. I got a variety of experiences within one sort of mission of service, and it became a self-selecting group, and it worked out well for me. This was a group of people who were very generous with their time. They were very supportive of my work. And interestingly enough, and I didn't know this going in with this particular group of people in this mission of service, but they're often trained to be highly verbal and to communicate verbally. The people attracted to the work are generally very good communicators, and it's encouraged for them to communicate. I haven't seen the movie The Hurt Locker. I hear it's a wonderful sort of fictional representation of what they do, but I also understand that the protagonist in that movie is sort of a renegade, sort of a cowboy, and he does things that he doesn't discuss with his team, and even though some people I spoke to said, oh, I enjoyed the movie, but you can't do that. I mean, they have to be in a constant state of communication with their team members. They have to come to, I don't want to say consensus as a group because the team leader makes the final decisions, but they can have different physical vantage points, viewpoints, individual areas of expertise in certain types of explosives or environments. So they're very much a group that works together verbally, and it worked out really well for me in my interviews. They were wonderful to speak to, and they could talk about their experiences very well.
That's very interesting. So what were some of the key findings from your interviews or your questionnaires
as well? You know, people talk, it's been sort of talked about a little bit in some other interviews, some of the smaller pieces of the puzzles. But overall, sort of the two big conceptual takeaways from this are that the EOD people I spoke to, from the data, there was one model they had, one human-human interaction model they had that consisted of very strong set pattern of expectations, beliefs, values, actions, and ways that they interacted with their human teammates. And this didn't really neatly overlap with their interactions with their field robots, which I called that interaction model the robot accommodation dilemma, in that they had sort of a facile way of, I should mention that within the questionnaire and the interview, because I asked this question twice, I asked them to define what a robot was in their own words. Every single response in both the interview response and the questionnaire, they all used either the word tool or mechanical, something like that. They're very aware, top of mind, that this is an inorganic thing. It's a tool that they're interacting with. But in their conversations and experiences and their relation to me of their interactions with the robots, they could go back and forth between discussing the robot as a critical tool, as something other than a tool, as something human-like, as something animal-like, or even as an extension of themselves.
Okay. So you mentioned something called robot accommodation dilemma. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
You know, I'm not the first person to talk about the way that people can interact with inanimate objects naturally. I mean, that can come out of human product interaction, human computer interaction. Other people have found, similar dynamics. But in this particular case, what I was really sort of describing was that whole dynamic of their going back and forth between saying, oh, no, I see it as a tool. It's a very important tool. It has its capabilities. It has its limitations. But I'm aware it's mechanical. And then perhaps in the next sentence, they might refer to it as he or she, which could be a linguistic convenience, except then they would go on to talk about a story where they treated it in a very much human-like way, or they named it after a dog, or they treated it in a pet-like way. Or they even referred to it, especially the people who are tasked as robot operators, as an extension of themselves, going so far as to say it acts as my hands. It's really an extension of my hands. So this sort of a struggle or challenge or finding new ways to interact with this very robust dynamic technology, or what I call the robot accommodation dilemma. How do we treat this thing that actually takes over some human-like roles, and in some canine, it actually takes over some roles that perhaps in the past a military working dog might have done, such as reconnaissance or sniffing out bombs, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of how people anthropomorphize different technological objects, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure I've told other people that my laptop is my best friend because it goes everywhere with me.
Right.
And I name all my computers, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. So is there anything that makes robots a special case of that? Or is it something that is a little bit different from just naming your maybe a pencil or a teddy bear or a laptop?
Well, it actually, you know, the robot has some characteristics in common with all of those things that you just named. I mean, like a pencil, it's a tool that you can be very important to you. Like a teddy bear, some robots might have a characteristic of something human-like or animal-like, though not in particular these EOD field robots, like a Talon or a Packbot. But like a teddy bear, it can be something that you are in close proximity with over a period of time. And sometimes when you're in a personally vulnerable situation, like deployment or stressful condition, like explosive ordnance disposal personnel are frequently in, it's part of their job to be in physical danger. And like a computer, I mean, robots are really embodied computers. So robots, you know, that's what attracted me to robots as a technology to investigate further years ago, because I'm so interested in them as this really, you know, they're embodied. They can appear to have agency with movement. They have varying levels of intelligence. They have varying levels of human-like or animal-like appearance. The tasks that they take on can be tasks that were assigned to humans or animals in the past. So all of these things together really sort of, in my mind, make it a very ripe condition for further investigating how maybe our natural instinct to anthropomorphize or zoomorphize something can apply to robots.
Mm-hmm. So these robots are perhaps one of the few types of robots designed or intended to be destroyed. I actually can't think of another example of robots built to be destroyed like this. So what were your subjects or the interviewed personnel's reaction of watching their robot being blown up into pieces?
That's a very good question. And the range of emotions, I would say, were one of the most frequent emotions that they cited was anger. And the anger would come from a couple of places that they explained to me. First, their initial reaction might be anger. Part of that's rooted in a feeling of ownership. That's my robot. You just destroyed my robot. You know, the same sort of feeling you might have if someone rear-ended your car and hopefully everyone was okay and you're like, you know, someone just wrecked my car. So there was that sort of reaction. There was also anger rooted in, related closely to frustration. And sometimes a sense of loss as well. Again, some of the operators describe the robot as really, in some ways, like a game avatar. It's something that stands in for themselves at a distance. They felt in sometimes like it was an extension of themselves, and they could feel elements of personal responsibility, even if the situation was obviously beyond their control. It was a technical limitation or a geographical limitation, a communication limitation, or just, you know, it was hit by sniper fire, something beyond their control, they still felt a certain responsibility. And then, of course, if a robot's disabled and a spare is unavailable or disabled as well, that means that the team leader has to put on a very heavy bomb suit and go out and get way too close to the ordnance and put themselves at great personal risk. So nobody wants to see that happen.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading your an interviewed article of quoting you that was cited on Reddit. And this person called Risky Donut wrote, "I'm not a soldier, but if there was something that on a daily basis protected and saved the lives of my friends and myself, I would name the heck out of it and hold the biggest, baddest funeral for it as well." is this something that resonates with the rest of your interviews? Something that is commonly found in from your studies?
There was definitely a theme of people would have rituals there was a theme of naming the robot that could possibly be, my study indicated, I think this needs to be looked at further. Some of that may have to do with the group, the particular team dynamic. Several people said that they named the robot when the members of the team were younger. And by younger, I would say like under 30, and that the older team members had less of a tendency to do something like name the robot after a dog or a girlfriend. There's possibly an age component in that. I haven't had a chance to investigate that further yet. But then there were other rituals that were similar to that. They would refer to it as sort of part of the family. But they were also very clear that, you know, losing a robot is not the same category as losing a human teammate. So some of this is done with, it's all things like that, traits like that, are done with a sense of humor, a way of, they're meaningful, and yet they're ways of dealing with stress, you know, letting off steam. You know, it's just all part of the bigger picture of being deployed and working closely with this technology.
Part of your research is also about determining if the relationship these soldiers or personnel have with robots could affect their decision-making ability, right?
Yes.
So did you find this to be the case? Is this something that the U.S. military should perhaps be worried about, or we should be worried about?
The people I spoke with said that they felt that it did not affect their decision-making in the heat of the moment. Again, these people are highly trained. Their concern is human safety. They're very aware that the robot is not actually a living thing, and it is, in fact, a tool, although a very, very important tool. So concern for the robot's life, if you will, did not affect their decision-making. Do we need to worry about this or investigate this further? Yes, I think that we need to investigate this further. These models that are in current use are not going to be the models that are necessarily in use, you know, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. The military it's very public information, uses some robots that are bipedal, quadruped, human-like. Many of us, especially robot fans, have seen Boston Dynamics, really exciting robots like Big Dog or Petman that's human-like, Big Dog that has four legs. And these are done with very real needs. For example, something with four legs or two legs might be able to move more nimbly in certain environments, geographical environments, urban environments, environments made and built by humans like a house. So the shape of the robot might change, the role of the robot within the team might change as the team itself changes. So it's something that needs to be continually and iteratively monitored and described and investigated.
Okay, so you're commenting a little bit on the appearance of the robots used today versus robots that may be used in the future.
Uh-huh.
So do you think if we had robots that looked very much human-like in future military battlefield situations, do you think that will affect people's decision-making? Is that, I know you haven't done studies on it, but is that your hypothesis, perhaps?
Do I predict that it will affect their decision-making? I think that there's research now that shows the nature of robots that even don't resemble humans and animals at all, that they have certain capabilities that could potentially either affect decision-making or affect the psychology of the operator. For example, there is recent research about drone operators. Many drones don't resemble human or animals at all. However, the context in which they're used, where an operator may be sitting in sort of an office-like atmosphere, for lack of a better term, during the day, operating the drone at a distance, and then have to sort of put all of that thought process aside and go home or go back to the barracks or whatever it is at night, that turning on and turning off of high levels of emotion could potentially have long-term effects on people's psychology. The cameras that are on the drones, people can have a very close-up view of all kinds of targets, and that can affect their mentality. It's very different than shooting or bombing something from a distance. They may be at a physical distance, but via the cameras, they can see exactly what's happening. So I think that regardless of the shape of the robot, all of these things need to be considered for the mental health of the troops, and as well as the effectiveness of the robot and the outcomes of each individual mission.
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting you're mentioning drones. We hear about them all the time now. But I understand that drone operators are at a very far physical distance, mm-hmm. and they don't really get to see their robots fly around as they're flying. They're looking at the camera stream from the robot's view, right?
As I understand it, that's correct. I have not had the opportunity to work with drone operators, but yes, according to the research that I've read, that's accurate.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the way they interact with robots, which is different from EOD-type robots, that has an effect on how people build relationships with these robots?
Oh, I'm speculating, but yes, I mean, I would say that there would probably be two very different human-robot interaction models.
Mm-hmm. So I also understand that you're writing a book to be published next year.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going to be on the book, when we can expect to see the book?
Hopefully spring of 2014 is what we're shooting for. And I'm excited about this opportunity for sure.
Great. Okay. So we're just going to wrap up here. Do you have any last comments or messages to the public based on your findings?
My dissertation that you mentioned the title of earlier will be available on ProQuest any day now. And if people have questions, they can email me and I will do my best to answer as many as I can in a timely fashion. I hope that this research is just a little piece of a larger puzzle that we'll continue to look at, because it has such an important impact. Emotions can't be, in my opinion, a neglected part of the study of human-robot interaction. Emotions are our dynamic way of assessing our environment and how we respond to this assessment. And that can affect things like decision making. And it's an important set of human factors to look at.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And that's the end of today's episode. Julie Carpenter is also currently writing a book on the topic of this podcast that is scheduled to be published next year. If you can't wait that long, you can find a wealth of additional information, images and videos, plus all our past episodes on our website at robotspodcaster.com. And remember, if you'd like to support the Robots Podcast, please consider making a donation on our website. Finally, like every year, we would once again like to invite you all to submit entries to our annual Festive Greetings competition. Entries can be video or audio tracks, and we will feature a selection of entries on our website and our dedicated YouTube channel. Check out our YouTube channel for entries from last year. So get creative and submit any entries via our website, robotspodcast.com. As always, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. EOD with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.